Okay, welcome to this briefing from the Science Media Center on genetically modified forage crops. We have three panelists that we've assembled here today. These are scientists who were involved in the assembling of the Royal Society of New Zealand Emerging Issues policy paper that's also being released today in conjunction with this briefing. The three scientists on our panel are Dr. Stephen Goldson, Dr. Michael Dunbier, and Dr. Caroline Saunders. Stephen Goldson is the Vice President of Biological and Life Sciences Committee for the Royal Society of New Zealand. He's also Chief Scientist at Ag Research and one of the members of the Prime Minister's Science Advisory Committee. Dr. Goldson has been involved in pest management and biosecurity research for 30 years, including the study of exotic weevil pests in pasture and their suppression using biological control and plant resistance. He's also contributed to many national biotechnology, biosecurity, and science policy advisory groups. Dr. Mike Dunbier is a research scientist with expertise in genetics and plant breeding and a former director of the DSIR Crop Research and founding chief executive of Crop and Food Research. He chairs the boards of the Bioprotection Center of Research Excellence, Pastoral Genomics Consortium, Horticulture and Zed Vegetable Research and Innovation Board, and the governance groups of two NIWA OBIs. He's also a director of the Foundation for Arable Research. And our third panelist, Dr. Caroline Saunders, is director of the AERU at the Commerce Division of Lincoln University. She has 20 years research expertise in the UK and New Zealand and over 100 publications specializing in economic impact of policy. Her current research is looking at economic development of New Zealand, especially in the regions, and this includes assessing optimum use of New Zealand resources to improve well-being of New Zealanders. She researches international trade, resource use in the regions, market access, and development of new technologies. She's also developing new ways of assessing the impact of development, including social and environmental impacts. So to start out this briefing, I will now hand over to Dr. Stephen Goldson.
So good morning, everybody.
Okay.
Thank you for this opportunity to say a few words on this paper that we've put out under the direction of the Royal Society. The discussion or debate continues around the potential benefits of transgenic plants versus their possible risks. And the focus of this presentation is on forage plants, which have been the subject of contained research in New Zealand for some years. The Royal Society has decided that it should involve itself more in science issues recently, and it's been putting out a series of papers on scientific issues such as ocean acidification, virtual water, and this paper is one of the series of scientific papers that the Royal Society has been putting out, and I was asked to lead it. And before I go any further, I'd like to thank the very large number of people that contributed to the discussion that led to the development of this paper. The focus of this paper is one of information, and the focus of the paper is on the emerging issues around the nature and use of such technology. I'd like to emphasize that the paper has no intention whatsoever of influencing ultimate decisions on its use or not, but it does seek to inform and update the debate around the use of such forages. That really is an information paper, and it really is an updating. We've tried to put it in a form that makes it accessible. It's not really a scientific paper. It's more a information paper for the interested public. Now, there's quite a bit has gone on since the Royal Commission on Genetic Modification in 1999. The situation in New Zealand pastures and their use has changed a lot in the last 10 years, and I think this has some bearing on the debate and consideration of this type of technology. Some of these changes, which I was just referring to before, are worth noting. And one very apparent one is the intensification of pastoral farming, and really the need to transform the sustainability of agriculture. So, if you like, the productivity is going up all the time. We are farming at an increasingly high level of precision, and we're moving towards the kind of technical limits of pasture production. There are increasing costs of farm inputs. Fertilizer and fuel are good examples. There's quite a lot of concern about phosphate. The world resources of phosphate are not infinite, so we're worried about A, the cost, and B, the availability of some of these things. And with that, there are concerns now about the potential limits of business as usual in agriculture. We may not be able to carry on as we have. On top of that, there is the now well-discussed need to mitigate the emission of greenhouse gases. And with that, closely related to that, is the need to adapt to probable climate change, where, amongst other things, we're going to be looking at more frequent and more intense droughts. We're facing increased competition from low-cost producers overseas. We're no longer the lowest-cost producer of pastoral products. It's just those that are lower cost tend to use those products for their own consumption rather than trade them as we do. But we do also, given that the sort of markets that we're trading with, we do have to consider increased animal welfare, particularly the nutrition of pastoral fed animals. And there are questions about the nutritional levels of some of our dairy herds. So irrespective of how, something has to be done if New Zealand's going to maintain its leadership in the pastoral industries. If we don't maintain our leadership in pasture and pastoral industries, it'll be a very bad prospect for New Zealand. So we really must make sure that we continue to be at the cutting edge. It's the area of technology and science where New Zealand truly does lead. In the last 10 years since the Royal Commission, there has been a major increase in the area of land being used to produce GM crops. Most of it's in the US, Argentina and Brazil, but it's spreading further. And these countries in green are those countries now which are, to some extent or a great extent, using transgenic crops. And there is a strong argument by the exponents of transgenic crops that they're important for food security. The Royal Society has noted that comment. It doesn't necessarily agree or disagree with it. I said that the aim of the Royal Society in putting this out was to inform, to some extent, the interested public, and the next bit of the talk really is just about that. There is a thing called traits. They're referred to quite a lot in the paper, and traits are really the expression, the recognisable expression of the underlying genes. And both classical breeding and GM methods focus on the acquisition and expression of genes resulting in these useful traits. And traits may confer things like herbicide tolerance and insect resistance. So the genes are the bit that matter, whether they are, if you like, exemplified through GM or classical breeding, and it's the genes that produce these traits. So when we start talking about safety testing of any types of plants or any form of plants, we must consider traits. And there is a view that it's the impact of these traits, these new traits, may be more important to be evaluated than actually how those traits were realized. In other words, it's the traits that count, not whether or not they were discovered through GM or classical breeding. And there is an argument in the science community, and quite a lot of the people that we talked to when we put this together did argue the need to look at traits and don't generalize. You need to look at each trait or trait by trait to make sure that they are okay, and that type of approach has real merit. That said, there's still strong attention paid to the GM component when we're considering GM plants. But it's not just a question of looking at whether it's GM or not. It's also a question of making sure that we understand what those traits are expressing and what that expression means in terms of safety and so forth. The experience of transgenic plants now offshore is enormous. There are 134 million hectares. There were 134 million hectares grown overseas in 2009. That is a lot more than there was at the time of the Royal Commission. And I would say the opinion is, the weight of opinion is, that there have been no consistent reports of untoward effects. I just want to make a comment also, which I should have made earlier on. The work that the science community has done on transgenic forages is now advanced. 10 years ago, the people talking about the use of transgenics and cisgenics were talking about what they would be able to do. Now we've got to the stage, or they've got to the stage, where there are plants in containment that are no longer theoretically able to do things. They actually are able to do things such as drought resistance and a better use of uptake of nutrients and insect resistance and so forth. So it's no longer a theoretical type of plant in containment. There are plants available. The question is whether or not those plants can be used for field evaluation, whether New Zealand people will allow them to be used for field evaluation, to check to see if those traits really are going to confer advantage. Anyway, what I was saying just now is that there's a large area. There's 134 million hectares grown around the world now, and there have been no consistent reports of untoward effects. New Zealand's taken an approach looking at two types of GM. One is cisgenics, and the other is transgenics, and it's useful to quickly refer to what these two things mean. Cisgenic modification involves manipulating genes only from the species being transformed. So that means if we're looking at a ryegrass plant, for example, genes are being moved around within that species of plant. So there may be the prospect of plants being rearranged, or there may be the prospect of getting genes out of one ryegrass plant and putting them into another line of ryegrass plants. So in other words, the genes belong to that species. Transgenics, the genes may well be sourced from elsewhere. Now, there may be less public concern about cisgenics because the genes are being moved within that species, but many in the science community doubt whether using cisgenics is any safer or more risky than using transgenics. But it is a focus. Some of our science groups have focused very much on the cisgenics approach. When we put this paper together, we did discuss opinions on the adverse effects of GM forages. And one of the issues around GM forages, if field trials were to be permitted, is that it can lead to the inadvertence of spread of GM plants. The pollen can distribute itself beyond the trial area, and therefore containment is problematic. There is an argument that plants with more vigour or tolerance to drought could produce more weediness because they may well survive better. There has been a long debate about horizontal gene transfer. That is a subject that's been talked about and worked on for a great deal of time. There is an opinion in the science community it's minute as a threat, as a risk, but it has to be still noted that there's concern about that. And there is some concern about unexpected metabolic effects through new kind of metabolic pathways through reassortment of genes. But there is a view that when mutagens are used to rearrange genetic material in classical breeding, exactly the same argument applies. We, in putting in putting this paper together, we spoke to a lot of people about social acceptability, and we know that the New Zealand national identity is closely linked to its concepts about nature and 100% pure and those other attributes we give to New Zealand. The clean green Maori, clean green image thing, and there are Maori values about whakapapa and so forth that that stand strong in New Zealand. There's a natural desire amongst New Zealanders to preserve options and not close down prospects. There is suspicion around food safety. There is concern about corporate ownership of food production systems, such that the people lose the right to produce their own food, and there are ethical and religious beliefs about modifying the natural state. Talking more about social acceptability, there are questions about who benefits from a perceived risk. Is it the company that owns the seed material, or is it the growers, or is it the consumers? And there are questions being asked and have been asked about that. There are benefit analyses as well. For example, there some people are weighing up the relative risk around GM strain, which confers resistance to pests, or they're considering whether pesticide contamination is a bigger threat. So these things need to be weighed up. I think one thing that we should point out, and it was pointed out during the conversations we were having, is that since 2000, GM plants, such as we have and that we've seen overseas, are demonstrably of greater value to the environment and sustainability than they were in the year 2000. The problem there, or the issue there, is that their benefits are diffuse. It's not something you can immediately recognize as a consumer society, and there are lags between the value to the environment and when it's finally realized. The social and market opposition, there may be, based on overseas analysis, attitudes may be changing resulting from climate change, increasing concern about security of food supply, and as I said to you, the concern about the impacts of agriculture on the environment. Consumer patterns, consumer purchasing patterns re-GM overseas are not particularly obvious. So we were told that while in surveys consumers say that they may prefer not to go for GM, it seems that in purchasing decisions this isn't as apparent. There's some quite complex questions which Caroline Saunders will talk about on the market value of GM-fed animals, and we got into quite lengthy discussion. And that is, what is the market difference in the value between a GM-fed animal or GM animals? And this is an important point of difference. Does the market see animals which are not GM but fed on GM forages differently from a GM animal? And there's another issue buried in here as well, and that's the difference in perceived value of non-GM products sourced from either GM-free countries or GM products sourced from GM-using countries. And generally it seems that the world markets are interested to know if a product's GM or not GM, rather than whether it's grown in a GM-free or a GM-permitting country. And as I said, the opinion we picked up was the world markets seem minimally concerned about that issue. There are emerging markets, such as China, which are ambivalent, apparently, re-GM, if there is a price advantage. And it must be noted that there are sophisticated markets that tolerate a degree of commingling of seeds, GM seeds and animal feed, to the extent that Japan, for example, accepts that 5% of products may comprise GM components. So just to conclude, real advances have been made in GM forages in containment. As I said, a next step is field evaluation to find out if they in fact do confer the advantages that we have seen in containment. As I said at the beginning, there is a need for New Zealand pasture systems to be protected and managed because of the external pressures which are coming on those pastures, particularly environmental considerations. The New Zealand public and market preference obviously matters in this discussion. There's a possible entree via cisgenics into New Zealand rather than transgenic. And Mike Dumbier, who will be able to discuss this subtlety between cisgenics and transgenics further. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen. This is Deja from Science Media Center. Just a couple of housekeeping notes before we move on to Mike's presentation. I'd like you to please hold your questions till the end of our three presenters. If you are logged in online and would like to put your hand up, as it were, you'll notice in the left column at the bottom there's a chat box. You can type a chat message there just saying that you have a question, your name, and I can call on you during the question portion. For those of you who are not able to log in, the slides from the presenters will be available in our resource library for you to download. They're there right now, or you can download those afterwards. There'll also be this audio recording will be posted to our website very shortly after the briefing concludes. So if you could please hold your questions to the end, and I will now pass on to Dr. Mike Dunbier.
Thank you. Good morning. Stephen outlined some of the issues that face the New Zealand pastoral industry, and I'll describe them a wee bit differently by saying what I see as the New Zealand pastoral industry conundrum, because the low-cost grazing systems that historically have been our competitive advantage are now being subject to greater scrutiny. And when we look closely at them, because customers are starting to look much more closely at issues and then no longer satisfied with slogans like free range or pasture fed, we need to look very carefully at the system overall. And when we look at our pastoral systems, we note that they need inputs and as distinct from annual crops. We can't do a fallow and save water to make to assist the crop. They also need nutrients, and also because they're perennial, they're more affected by climatic extremes than annual crops, where we can, with annual crops, we can avoid temperature extremes by sowing a little earlier or a little later, but we can't do that with perennial pastures. And also, we note that the pastoral system is a major contributor to New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions, whether it's through methane from the animals burping or from nitrous oxide. And they also can contribute quite seriously to nitrate pollution because, unfortunately, none of these grazing animals are toilet trained, and they deposit their feces and urine in large quantities, and the nutrient return through those is at a much greater level, orders of magnitude greater level than we would do if we were adding fertiliser. The other issue that is important in trying to address this sort of complex biological problem is that we don't have the same background or basis of history of improvement of plants that we do in the cropping areas. The crops have been selected for many years for specific purposes, so we have bread that's selected specifically for wheat that's selected specifically for bread making, or barley that's selected specifically for malting, and you'll all know about sweet corn. But we don't have that degree of specificity in the pastoral system. We have grass and clover generally, and we just treat it as grass and clover. Now, I'd just like to talk about the organisations that are represented in the two examples of the research programs that I'll be talking about. First one's pastoral genomics. It's funded by farmers. It's an industry good consortium and is working on development of using gene technologies to develop improved ryegrass and clover using both marker-assisted selection techniques and also gene technology, and we're using cisgenics. And the other one is AgResearch, which will be familiar to all of you, I'm sure. And I make the point of these two organisations only because the benefits that are being targeted and the intellectual property that's being developed is owned by New Zealanders, either New Zealand farmers or the New Zealand government. Now, the research projects that we have are targeted really in two main areas. One is to improve the quality of the forage. That's so that for every leaf blade that there is more energy or more productivity in it, or reducing input so that the plants will require less water or less nutrients to perform at a particular level. And AgResearch has got three effective programs, essentially all tailored to produce more energy, either through increasing the oil content of the plant, because we all know that oils, in fact, have more energy concentrated than carbohydrates. That they have reduced lignin, which is a structural component of the plant, so that it may be digested faster, or that they have a better balance between the sugars and the protein in the grass. And pastoral genomics is looking at drought tolerance, at some improvement in growth, and we've contracted AgResearch to do some work on high sugars, but also we're getting some really interesting preliminary results on fertiliser use efficiency and water use efficiency. Yeah, Stephen said phosphate is a limited resource. Nitrogen has very high energy component, and the consequences of excess nitrogen are very apparent in our livers, in our rivers and in our lakes. So we're essentially looking at it, at trying to improve the productivity and efficiency of production and the sustainability and resilience of production. And I'll give you just two examples. First one is the high sugar grasses. When tourists come into New Zealand, they always talk about seeing what looks like a lot of golf courses, and that's closely grazed pasture where young, actively growing leaves contain much more protein than the animal can actually utilise effectively in the rumen. What we think we can do is to have what's effectively a master switch to improve the sugar content substantially. We've got some conventionally bred high sugar grasses that are giving some good results, but we still don't think that that's enough to get more efficient protein management in the rumen, so that more of the protein goes into the meat and the milk, and significantly less goes into the urine, and consequently can form nitrous oxide and be an issue with greenhouse gases. And there's some evidence that a higher energy content forage will also decrease methane production. So we're looking at not producing more forage, but producing better forage that will produce more and have less environmental consequence. Now, the second example I'll use is tolerance to drought. Drought, unfortunately, is a common factor to many parts of New Zealand in the summertime, and it has significant economic and animal health and welfare effects. And you will all have seen photos of skinny ewes on barren pastures. And the economic effects are very significant. And in Northland this year, some of the farmers went on to once-a-day milking or dried their cows off in January and February. And what we think is that if we can get some weeks additional growth in New Zealand dry periods, that this would extend the peak of animal production, make it easier to match supply with processing capability, and it might also reduce irrigation costs. You might say, why are we worried about drought tolerance when we can irrigate? But if we can spread out the irrigation cycles, then we save a lot of electricity. And what we're using is the cisgenic approach to switch on a ryegrass gene so that it's effective when the plant's under moisture stress. And we're starting to get some really interesting and positive results from that in the laboratory and in containment. And I'll just show you a photograph of a trial that we've been running in the Biotron at Lincoln, where plants were subjected to 28 degrees centigrade for 6 weeks and given no additional water. If you just look at the four plants on the bottom of the circle, they're all propagules of the same parent ryegrass plant from the established variety Impact. And the plant on the extreme left and the plant third from the left have been transformed to include the cis gene that I talked about. The second plant and the right-hand plant have not. And we think that that's a really significant finding, and we're looking to do further evaluation because we think that's significant. Now, we've tried to get economic evaluation of the benefits of these traits. Just the example I've got here is the pastoral genomics one. We've evaluated it at a productivity level, at an individual farm level, and tried to take it through to a national level. And while there's variability in the results depending on the particular variety and the adoption rate, the GDP increase calculated is very significant. The Wee diagram on the right has got what we think is potentially a step change in productivity. Now, these things that I've talked about are all being done in the laboratory and in containment, and they're what we call advanced proof of concept testing. And the next slide and the last slide tries to give us a timeline of where things might end up. Now, if you look at the end of the green arrow in the middle, we're getting to the end of what we think is the proof of concept stage. We think we can see the potential benefits. The next stage is field evaluation and some cultivar development. But even if things go swimmingly from now on, we're not going to end up with plants that are commercially available and animals are eating them for 8 or 10 more years. So the conclusion of this bit of the presentation really is that we think that we have got some tools that we can address some of the thorny issues of the pastoral conundrum. We're about to consider how we go through further evaluation and see how they look in the field. But even if things go really well, there's a long time before they will be commercially available, so that some of the issues about current consumer attitudes and market attitudes are things that we need to monitor going forward, but they're not of immediate concern. So I'll conclude then and pass on to Caroline.